Welcome to All Things Political. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn. It's been a big week in the news with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressing Congress, the Hillary Clinton email controversy, and yet another African-American teen killed by police. Our guest today is Carl Cannon. He's the Washington Bureau Chief of Real Clear Politics. Carl is a past recipient of the Gerald R. Ford Journalism Prize for Distinguished Reporting and the Aldo Beckman Award, the two most prestigious awards for White House coverage. We're happy to have Carl Cannon with us today. Carl, thank you so much for joining us for All Things Political.
Judith, I'm happy to do it. And I'm especially happy because your name's Judith. That's my only sister's name, and I love her dearly.
Oh, well, I'm glad. I hope you feel like you're talking with your dear sister today. Well, we have a lot to talk about. I think every week, you know, there's some big stories, but it seems like this week, there have been some very big issues. I'd like to start with the fact that on Wednesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed a joint session of Congress. He was invited by House Speaker John Boehner, who did not alert the White House until after the invitation had been made and accepted. First of all, can you recap for us at what stage the negotiations are between Iran and the U.S. on the issue of Iran's nuclear ambitions?
Well, the United States, along with the other UN Security Council nations and Germany, it's P5 plus one, which is the silly acronym that Nancy Pelosi used when she criticized the speech, they're negotiating with Iran. And the negotiations are, you know, whether this country should have a nuclear program. Iran is a sovereign country, and it's a regional power, a very prideful nation, and it wants to have nuclear weapons. It doesn't say this publicly, but it knows that Israel has nuclear weapons. So does India, Pakistan. And it wants to take its place in the nuclear, you know, community. It doesn't say that. It's originally said, it said a lot of different things, many of them contradictory, but that it was doing this for energy. Well, it's got all this oil, so people didn't believe that. Mm-hmm. But now that fiction's gone, and they're negotiating. And but because this is a nation that exports terrorism and calls for Israel's destruction, the Western world and most thought people are worried that this regime should have an atom bomb. That's where the negotiations are, and that's what started these negotiations. Iran is saying its intentions are peaceful. It's still saying it's not trying to build weapons. That's its official version. And details of the proposed agreement have been leaking out, and Israel is uncomfortable with it. And Netanyahu is not the only one. Now, you know, when you're Prime Minister of Israel, you don't need 51% like Barack Obama mm-hmm. needs, although he got more than that. You need, you know, 24-25%, which is the Likud party got. He's in charge of that country. But across the board, people in Israel think that a nuclear-armed Iran is an existential threat, and they're worried that the United States and some of these Western allies are not as mm-hmm. you know, not as vigilant as we trust the Iranians too much. So Netanyahu wanted to make his speech to Congress.
I want to go back to something that you said, Carl, though, because I think it's really, really key. Israel has never publicly acknowledged it, but it is well known that they have nuclear weapons. And not only that, they were actually working with Iran on nuclear development under the Shah, certainly, you know, considered a different time in Iran's history. But how does the issue not come up in this conflict? How does it not come up that Israel is a nuclear power in that region?
Well, Israel's never acknowledged it. We believe it's true. The United States government believes it's true. Israel's never acknowledged it. But, you know, that's not really Iranian leaders will occasionally mention this in passing over the years. They have allude to it is a better way of saying it. But no one really thinks Israel would use these weapons except defensively. I actually think for Iran, Pakistan having the bomb is even a bigger thing in their minds in India. Mm-hmm. You know, when Pakistan got the bomb, and they got it from North Korea through spying mostly, people in Pakistan, this is the Islamic bomb. That's what people called it. But they're not Shiites. And the division between Sunni Muslims and Shia Muslims in this country, we tend to underestimate how powerful it is. So Iran has other things in mind. They have Russia in mind, and they have India in mind and Pakistan in mind. So Israel's not really their fear, but Iran is Israel's fear.
Mm-hmm. It seems like the White House is saying that this deal is better than no deal, but Netanyahu is saying that no deal is better than a bad deal. Where would you put the actual potential outcomes on that spectrum?
Well, what the president is saying is that he understands the threat and that he won't agree to a deal that doesn't protect the United States and doesn't protect Israel. He's been clear on that. The difference is, you know, and he's also said, and John Kerry has said, the Secretary of State, who's the United States point person in these talks, has said that, you know, you don't know all the details. And for the Senate to impose sanctions, increase sanctions against Iran, for Bibi Netanyahu to come here and rail against this deal, they really don't know what they're talking about. You know, many Americans are inclined to believe that because we don't know the details either. The problem for some people, conservatives, Israelis, and some other people, is it sounds too much like trust us. And it's not that Netanyahu doesn't trust Obama. He really doesn't trust the Iranians. And he doesn't, I would say, and Nancy Pelosi said this was condescending, but I would say that what Netanyahu believes is that the Obama administration doesn't fully understand how bad the Iranians are, how much they'll lie, how bad they are. That was his pitch to the Congress and by extension to the United States people, to the American people.
Isn't that pretty condescending, though?
Well, I don't think it's condescending. Nancy Pelosi used that expression. I've known Nancy. I mean, I wouldn't say we grew up together because I was a reporter in the Bay Area and she was an up-and-coming Democratic politician in local politics. But she used that phrase. I didn't feel that way. I think, you know, I'm inclined to, I mean, I'll give you my opinion here. I'm inclined to trust the Obama administration and John Kerry more than the congressional Republicans are, a lot more. But I also think that Netanyahu has a right to come here and make his case. I thought the administration mishandled it. I thought they overreacted. They could either ignore Netanyahu, which some people urged them to do, some Democrats, or they could engage him. But they acted like they were afraid of his arguments. Mm. And if you're afraid of his arguments, a person on the fence like me, I don't know who to believe, you know, makes me think, well, if they don't trust their arguments, why should I trust their arguments? Mm-hmm. And so I think they mishandled that in a way. I think you let the guy have his peace. And I think the president, instead of coming out, the White House talking points were, there's nothing new here, BB wants a war, all this kind of thing. I think what they should have said was acknowledge, look, he's afraid, he's worried, we are too. That's why we're being very vigilant in these talks. If you saw the president yesterday in his interview with Bill Plant of CBS, he said this. He said, look, I'll walk away from a bad deal. And I think that should have been their line, because I think you've got to trust the guy to do that.
Netanyahu is up for re-election later this month, and that was kind of one of the sideshows to this issue, was that as a candidate who's up for election shortly, that he should not have been given that bully pulpit in front of Congress to make this address. What did Netanyahu hope to accomplish as a candidate with this speech?
Well, so far the polls in Israel haven't moved much, so I don't think anybody in Israel is going to base their vote on Bibi coming here and giving a speech. But what he hoped to do was inspire enough Republicans and Democrats in the Senate to put Kerry's feet to the fire. That's what I think he was trying to do. What the White House thinks he was trying to do is show people, you know, support his base, rally his base back home, the Likud base, the conservative base in Israel. Now, they're not mutually exclusive points. The president could be right. But there's a little bit of concern I have that if you say everything's political, you know, the way the Obama administration seems to be saying, some of the Democratic people, in psychology, we call that projecting, right? Mm-hmm. maybe they think everything's political. I don't know what's in Netanyahu's mind. I mean, he gave an interesting speech. Did you hear the speech,
Judy? I heard parts of it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, people forget he went to school in Philadelphia. You know, he speaks idiomatic English,
right,
with a slight, you know, South Philly accent. He uses American touchstones, American popular culture references. Mm-hmm. He knew enough about Congress. He gave these grace notes at the beginning of his talk. He praised the president by name for things that no one in there could have known that the president had done for him, including helping them with some forest fires they had in Israel that didn't even make the news here. He called John Kerry a friend. He praised Harry Reid by name. Harry Reid had an injury while he was working out. He said, Harry, it's good to see you back on your feet. You can't keep a good man down. I mean, the speech as constructed was very effective, you know, and you realize he's a pretty good communicator, as is our president, mm-hmm. right? So we shouldn't surprise these heads of state. These guys who win national elections usually can speak. But I think, you know, I think he was here trying to make his case because at some point the president's not going to bring this deal to the Senate as a treaty to be ratified. He's not going to do that. But at some point Congress is going to weigh in some form. And I think he was trying to, toughen up Congress.
We are talking with Carl Cannon. He is the Washington Bureau Chief of Real Clear Politics. He is a past recipient of the Gerald R. Ford Journalism Prize for Distinguished Reporting. We are talking currently about the address by Benjamin Netanyahu in front of the U.S. Congress. We are also going to talk about Hillary Clinton's email scandal. We are also going to talk about David Petraeus' plea deal. And of course, we are going to talk about the report on the Ferguson Police Department and the shooting over the weekend of another African-American teen in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on All Things Political. You can join in at 1-800-486-8655. That's 800-486-8655 on any of these topics or one that you have been following in the last week. And Carl, let's actually go to the phones. And Dave in Menominee, Michigan is up. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I would add one note about Prime Minister Netanyahu. He came here in 2002 and said the best thing we could do is go and take out Saddam Hussein. That would be the best thing for the region. So, he was completely wrong about that, too. I was, what I'm calling about is how the undermining of the government is happening, I think, with the, you know, the way the Republicans are really going. And I don't know, nobody has said the word treasonous, but there's kind of a record of this. They have a pattern of this. We know the LBJ has released tapes, and he talks about how Nixon is undermining the Vietnam talks to try to hold off the talks until after the election. You know, we know about how Reagan, what he did with the hostages. He was a candidate, and they undermined it. They went behind our government's back and held those hostages and rewarded Iran with weapons. And this is what Republicans have been doing. They do this to win, and they don't care. And I want to get your guest thoughts on that.
All right. Thanks for that call, Dave. Carl?
Well, I can't credit any of that. I don't. Nixon, I've never defended, and I won't try. The stuff about Reagan and the hostages is just wrong. Reagan, I will tell you an interesting story, though, that Mike Deaver told me, which is that after the election was won, people may forget, but the Iranians wouldn't give the American hostages. They wouldn't let these hostages go. And remember how this was portrayed at the time? You know, these were student activists, Judith. Well, mm-hmm. They weren't student activists. They were. It was the Iranian government. It was mm-hmm. the new Khomeini government, and they were holding these people, and they wouldn't let them go. Reagan defeated Carter rather handily, and in a three-way election between Jimmy Carter and Paul Anderson. I almost forgot his name, isn't it?
John Anderson.
John Anderson from Illinois, right?
Yep.
John Anderson. And then we kept expecting the hostages would be released, but they weren't. And Reagan, over time, during the transition, began to feel badly about this. He instructed Deaver. The Iranians had said, we're going to release these on Inauguration Day. They had such animus for Carter, and I don't know why. It never seemed rational, really. And he was going to call Jimmy Carter up on the podium, up to the stage, during the inauguration, if the hostages were free. And he didn't want to do it before then because we weren't sure they would really release the hostages. And the Iranians waited until Reagan had taken the oath of office and the inauguration was over before these guys cleared Iranian airspace. That, I've often thought if the Iranians had just miscalculated, maybe, you know, screwed up the time difference by 1 hour, how nice it would have been, because Reagan was going to call Jimmy Carter up that. And I think that would have been a great gesture for Pan-American, you know, for unity. But he wasn't able to do it.
We are talking with Carl Cannon today on All Things Political. You can join in at 1-800-486-8655. That's 800-486-8655. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. As we've discussed, on Friday night, a Madison police officer shot and killed an unarmed black teenager. Since then, there have been many protests and community meetings in Madison. On Central Time later today, a reporter who covered a walkout at all Madison schools and other protests discusses the latest on this story. That's Central Time after 3 o'clock today. Right now, we are talking with Carl Cannon. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for Real Clear Politics. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn, and it is all things political. So, Carl, one of the issues in the last week was the fact that Hillary Clinton is under fire for not only using a personal email account exclusively for her correspondence while heading the State Department, but it was also housed on a private server that Clinton owned. Is that in and of itself illegal?
Well, Judith, that's a good question. The Presidential Records Act has been interpreted so that, you know, emails sent on government stationery, now remember this act was written before email had been invented, that these are all public records and the understanding is, and there have been court decisions and new rules promulgated, as we say in Washington, about what's personal. You know, it's not supposed, if Hillary Clinton is sending an email about Chelsea's wedding, about the caterer, you know, that's not supposed to be a public record. What Hillary Clinton did apparently was forestall all those kinds of discussions by just not having a State Department email account at all and just doing everything on a private server. And now she's saying, okay, I'll give you, you know, if I can turn over anything that is relevant. I don't think the controversy is really, well, there's two parts to it. One, the question you asked, was this even proper? Probably not. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not going to practice law in the newspapers. I don't think it's a crime. I don't think it honors the spirit of the Presidential Records Act, whether it violates the literal law. Probably not. Be my guess. But the big thing now is, who's going to decide what's public and private? Mm-hmm. Somebody has to go through those emails and turn them over to a House subcommittee investigating.
I think the last number I saw was 55,000, maybe?
Well, that's what she said.
That's what she's turned over so far, or has made accessible.
Right, but there, you know, how many, is there another 55,000? Is there 255,000? The story is going to hinge pretty soon, Judith, on who gets to decide what's personal and what isn't. Mm-hmm. And it comes down to, you know, do you trust the former secretary and her aides to represent that accurately? Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be a tough sell for them. I think you're going to need an independent person, maybe not a Republican Party, you know, investigator, but an independent, somebody independent, go through those and say, okay, these are personal, and they come out of it. These are the government's property.
The argument has been made that during her tenure at the State Department that not all emails were archived anyway. So the fact that she worked outside of that system, it's being presented as, does not mean that anything additional was lost or deleted. Do you find that convincing?
I just don't know. You know, this story broke on us, and it's interesting because you had another committee in the previous Congress, also run by Republicans, and they didn't turn up any of this. And you have this Trey Gowdy's come in, he said, all right, I want to see the emails, and suddenly, oh, but we don't have them, mm-hmm, to the state. You know, this is kind of a surprise. Now, apparently, the White House counsel's office and the Hill, the Republicans on the Hill, have been negotiating this since August, but it was all news to you and me and everybody else in the country till last week when the New York Times broke the story.
Well, regardless of legality, and obviously legality is an element of this, but it certainly does seem hypocritical that Hillary Clinton dismissed staffers, including the former ambassador to Kenya, for basically the same thing that she's now under fire for. That ambassador routinely, the reason he was dismissed, he was told, was that he routinely used an unauthorized email account to conduct official government business.
Well, when Bill Clinton was president, he cashiered an admiral for having an extramarital affair. I mean, that hypocrisy seems too mild a word. But look, they didn't follow the protocols. They didn't do what the administration asked them to do. The president asked them to do. And the question is why. Now, it has nothing to do with Benghazi. Remember this, it predates Benghazi. It predates Hillary Clinton being confirmed in the office. They set this thing up in anticipation of it. Now, the probe into what happened in Benghazi is what led us to this. But the question is, why did they do this? They haven't really said. And that's surprising me. The Clintons have not only been around the block, they've been around the investigation block. They have, you know, survived Republican witch hunts. They have said things were Republican witch hunts that weren't. They have been on all sides of controversy. And but we don't even know their official story yet. Hmm. They've sent out Lanny Davis, who's a dear friend of mine, on the talk shows this weekend to say, well, what about Scott Walker's emails? That's a subject you would know more about than me. What about Jeb Bush's emails?
Right.
I called Lanny. I said, Lanny, you know, I don't know anything about Jeb Bush's emails, but I'm pretty sure of one thing. The Presidential Records Act doesn't cover anything that happened in Madison or Tallahassee.
Right.
Why did she do this? Well, he doesn't know. And I mean, we're going to have to find out what they were thinking, why they did this, and you're going to need an independent person to come in and look at the emails. Hopefully, you know, I mean, when I say hopefully, I mean for the Republic. I'm tired of investigations. Hopefully there's nothing there. But you wonder why people would hide things if they didn't have something to hide.
We are talking with Carl Cannon. He is the Washington Bureau Chief of Real Clear Politics. This is All Things Political. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Kathleen Dunn, who will be back tomorrow. Our phone lines, actually, we have one phone line open at 800-486-8655. We'd be happy to hear what you think about the Clinton email situation. We'll be talking about General Petraeus and his plea deal. We've talked about Benjamin Netanyahu, and we will, of course, be talking about the shooting of Tony Robinson in Madison. Let's go next to Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Yeah, what I wanted to call about is something that happened in New Jersey, but it seems to me is reflective of a trend throughout the country. And I'm not excluding Democrats for some part of this behavior as well, with the exception of people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. The Daily Kos, KOS, had a story about Christie settling a $9 billion pollution case against Exxon for $250 million. And what happened is they went through four governors in the state of New Jersey and came up with an $8.9 billion settlement, which was not in dispute. It was just a matter of what the company would settle for. And this involved the pollution of 1,500 acres of wetlands, marshes, meadows, and waters in northern New Jersey with potentially cancer-causing chemicals. And so this was litigated out and taken care of, and then ultimately, Christie settled for the amount, which was of $250 million, which was 3% of the total. And even that is, when you delve into the comments section, the governor has quite a bit of discretion about where that money goes, and it may not indeed go for environmental reconstitution or improving the environment or cleaning it up. It also pointed out in the article that Exxon contributed $500,000 to the Republican Governors Association in May 2014, and the association, of course, is headed by Christie. So they got a nice return on their money, and no doubt after he retires, Christie will have a nice position on the board of directors for Exxon.
Let's have Carl Cannon respond to that. So, Carl, the settlement with Exxon.
Well, I wouldn't casually accuse Chris Christie of being a felon, which is what bribery makes you. But I would agree with the call, and I wouldn't say that a $225 million settlement is nothing. That strikes me as a huge amount. The caller's right. The state originally said they wanted nearly $9 billion, but one assumes that was the opening salvo in a negotiation. Whether the $225 million is, you know, a fair amount, I have no idea. And I doubt whether this caller does or anybody in Wisconsin does, unless they used to work on the legal team in the New Jersey thing and have retired to your fair state. But I will say this. I'll agree with the caller in one way. These corporate contributions, $500,000 to the National Governors Association, doesn't that raise a question? And, you know, that's really what we were talking about also in a way, in a roundabout way, with the Hillary Clinton emails. The suspicion in Washington is that what the emails would show is that is that she was raising money for the Clinton Foundation while Secretary of State. That's not illegal. There's not necessarily anything wrong with it. The foundation does plenty of good work. But this appearance that in American politics you have to pay to play is it's more than an appearance. And the caller's also right. Both parties do it. And it's why there's this hunger in the Democratic Party and in liberal circles for a candidate like Elizabeth Warren. He also mentioned Bernie Sanders. You know, I think that the Clintons could be challenged from the liberal side of their from that party, because there's a populist streak in both parties, actually. You see it with Rand Paul on the Republican side. Elizabeth Warren, can I talk about her for a minute,
sure.
Judith? Is that all
Please
right?
Please do.
She's an interesting, sort of a breath of fresh air in Washington, where I live and work. Elizabeth Warren seems to believe, she doesn't say it this directly, she's really cautious when she speaks, but I mean that in a good way. She seems to think that capitalism is an insider's game, or has become that. Certainly the people who want her to run for president think that. And I wrote a book about this, a book called The Circle of Greed, and it was about these lawyers who sued all these companies. And they sued them, and Bill Larac and Mel Weiss, they sued them and made themselves fantastically rich and kind of became what they opposed. And they went to jail because they were committing fraud themselves. But they were after corporate fraud. And you know what? They kept finding it. Insider trading is endemic. This is what they discovered. And if people think that capitalism's a rigged game, you lose faith in really part of the American system. And to have a I hope that we have a primary. I hope we have a primary. And I'm not saying I'm rooting against Hillary Clinton. She's the likely nominee still. But it'd be nice to have somebody who brings these issues up. The income, the growing disparity in the rich and the poor, why these banks are too big to fail, all of the things that go on where, you know, you privatize grotesque, obscene profits, but you nationalize losses. So there's no risk to these people. And I really think that's the big current in the Democratic Party, and Elizabeth Warren is certainly someone who could tap into it.
We have caller Jude on the line from Ellison Bay, going back to the Hillary Clinton situation. Hi, Jude.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, and you maybe have addressed it, the emails. You know, they started out so recently, and they were always in a state of flux. You erased as many as you sent. And, you know, at what point do you have to save all of them, and what makes that difference than phone calls? Because in most cases, I believe, you know, emails have replaced a phone call. And if we're going to require all those be saved, should we be taping every phone call a public official makes?
That's an interesting point, Carl.
Well, I agree with her. It's a very interesting point. But, you know, the law hasn't really caught up with customs, with what people do in real time.
Well, and with technology itself.
That's right, in the real world. You know, George W. Bush was the first president who emailed. He emailed while he was governor. He was an inveterate emailer. He was an early adapter, we used to say, in the Silicon Valley where I grew up. When he became president, he looked at that law. He thought, man, I can't send emails. They're all public records. And I think, and can't prove, that he set up a private account only for his family that he would use with Jeb and his brothers and Dora, his sister. I don't know this for a fact, but he was very careful about it, and he read this thing literally. I think what Hillary Clinton's done is what Judas suggested, is she's applied sort of a real world. Wait a minute, you know. Look, I'm at Real Clear Politics. Look, we've been on the show for half an hour. I think your listeners can already tell I'm sort of bipartisan by temperament and by design. Our website has, you know, Republicans, Democrats. We aggregate. We really try to be the honest broker. But look, I got an email account. I send stuff to my brothers about my mom's nursing home. I send stuff to KP, your producer, saying when he'll call. I send stuff to banks and family members and old girlfriends. And, you know, I wouldn't want everybody going through this. But it's a work account. And so in that sense, your caller's right. Email is now it's exactly like phone calls. And in some cases, like verbal conversations.
Right.
Because, you know, there'll be somebody, I've got the door closed because I'm doing an interview with you. Somebody's going to send, I'm sure if I looked at my email, somebody's from my outer office, one of my reporters has sent me an email while we've been talking. It's the way we communicate. Maybe the law ought to be updated. It's been updated a couple of times, but Jude's right. There's some confusion here about what's even practical, let alone legal.
Mm-hmm. And that's going to be something that's going to develop, I think, with technology and with practice. And those things are going to keep evolving also. So I think we'll always be trying to play catch up on that. Well, thanks for that call, Jude. You can join in at 1-800-486-8655. That's 800-486-8655. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Kathleen Dunn, who will be back tomorrow. And we are talking with Carl Cannon of Real Clear Politics. Well, on the theme of sharing information, General David Petraeus has reached a plea deal over sharing classified information with his mistress when he was head of the CIA. Prosecutors will recommend a sentence of probation for 2 years and a $40,000 fine. Carl Cannon, do you think that's steep enough punishment, considering he has a very lucrative private sector career to look forward to?
Well, that's Judith, you've cut me to the quick there. $40,000, you know. Look, for me, that would be a real deterrent, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's one speech for Dave Petraeus.
Exactly.
When he's out on the speaking circuit. I'm not sure the judge is going to go for it. You know, it's a plea deal. Petraeus has agreed to plead guilty. The government's agreed to no prison time. I think that's the basic deal. If the judge, made that fine 10 times as large, I think that'd be probably more of a deterrent. But look, Dave Petraeus was, mentioned frequently, vice president, maybe president.
Mm-hmm.
This really, his career is over in public service, the way that he thought of it. So it's not like he paid no price. And it's also not like he was, he wasn't giving these classified information to Russians. You know, he was sharing it with a girlfriend who was writing a puff piece about him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a sad but very human story. And, I know Petraeus, and to me, it's a loss for the country that he's not able to help, because he was highly trained and as a warrior but
they say he is helping. They say that he is still a trusted advisor just behind the scenes.
Yeah, well, he can't handle classified information though.
Yeah.
I'll tell you that.
Well, and let's delve into this just a little bit more, because we talked about how this, whether it's supposed to be a deterrent. I mean, the way you described it, pillow talk with his mistress, probably not going to happen again, where he's in a position with any information that should not be shared. But how do we compare how he is being treated with, say, Edward Snowden?
Well, look, Snowden took it on the lam. I don't know about him, but how about this guy who talked to James Rosen at Fox News? He's in jail now. His career's over. He couldn't get a job. He thinks he's going to be working at McDonald's. There's a lawyer in Washington named Mark Zaid, Z-A-I-D. He specializes in national security issues, and he called it, to your point, this plea bargain, a sweetheart deal. I'm going to read you a quote from Mark Zaid. I've got clients being prosecuted for the same things with more severe sentences. They are absolutely getting jail time. He says it's frustrating to see someone at this level getting off light when the little people seem to have their lives ruined. So, to your point, you're not the only one who thinks that. A lot of people think that, and people who are in this field. Stephen Aftergood, who directs the Project on Government Secrecy for the American Federation of Scientists, he's also a Washington guy. He said he thinks it's appropriate, but he added, it's hard to reconcile in other cases like this where people have gotten jail time that senior officials are, quote, held to a different and more forgiving standard than others, end quote.
Mm-hmm.
That's for the judge to consider, and I think he should consider it.
Well, and that will be interesting to see what that judge does decide. We are talking with Carl Cannon. He's the Washington Bureau Chief of Real Clear Politics and past recipient of the Gerald R. Ford Journalism Prize for Distinguished Reporting. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. This is All Things Political on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, it is All Things Political, and we are talking with Carl Cannon. And Carl, let's go back to the phones, and Kurt in Poinette is up next. Hi, Kurt.
Hello. I have like to get back to a quick question about the speech before Congress by the Israeli president. And I'd like to hear your guest comment. If the tables were turned several years ago when President Obama was running for re-election, if he were invited by the Israeli Knesset to speak before them, several weeks before the American election, without Netanyahu's authority. What would you think about that if the tables were turned?
Thanks for that call, Kurt. Carl?
That's a nice thought experiment. I'm beginning to suspect that your listenership skews liberal, Judith.
I'm not sure that that's across the board, but...
Really? No, but I mean generally, but that's a very interesting... I can't even... Well, what would Mitt Romney have said? That's a good one. Good one on you. I like it. I think that helps illustrate the problem.
It is certainly.
It's made me rethink my position a little bit. Actually, I tend to think like Mao used to say, "Let a thousand flowers bloom." I like to hear everybody speak, but that caller has a good one.
So I think what I'll say, Carl, is that our listenership skews intelligent. How's that?
You know, in this case, yeah.
Well, thank you very much for that point, Kurt. It's certainly something to think about. I want to make sure that we save enough time to talk about this very unfortunate situation in Madison this weekend and how it ties in. Last week, we saw the Department of Justice's finding of prevalent systemic racism within the Ferguson, Missouri Police Department. And first, let's talk about that report. Were there any big surprises, Carl, or was it more a matter of scale in what was reported?
Well, in to my way of thinking, it was sadly predictable. You know, when the Michael Brown shooting happened, the facts, the individual facts of this case from a law enforcement standpoint, i.e. whether Officer Darren Wilson should have been charged with a crime, were not very clear-cut and not really very supportive of the idea that the officer committed a murder. However, that police department, it was clear from the day the story broke that they had a problem there. And it reminded me of the Los Angeles Police Department. I'm from California, but before the Rodney King case and before the riot, the ACLU had a study there of the police department and the attitudes that the people in South Central had and in Watts and in East Los Angeles, largely Mexican-American area. And the attitude of the people who lived in that community was that the LAPD was like an occupying army, and that was the name of their report. And this all came back to me, like deja vu when Ferguson, you have this inner suburb, you know, inner city slash suburb that's 67-70% African-American, a police department which I think 51 or 54 officers are white, most of them don't live in the community, and, you know, you just got this bad feeling that this was an example. They were like an occupying army. And even if this policeman didn't, you know, even leaving aside the facts of this case, I don't wish to second guess the grand jury or the prosecutor or the Justice Department, but I thought Eric Holder was right. And I was grateful that he, as an American citizen, that he did that he looked at the bigger picture here. The president did too. You know, okay, but did this have to happen? The fact that a shooting is justified legally doesn't mean it should have occurred.
Right.
And this idea that you had this police department with these racists in it and this whole sort of mentality that black people are less than fully invested in the citizenry, it's disgusting. You would hope it doesn't go on in the 21st century, but we know it does. And if I may, Judith, bring up the speech that the president gave in Selma.
Please do.
Over the weekend. You know, the president, not just because he's the first African-American president, not just because he has a black father and a white mother, but because of what's going on in this country, he is literally in the middle of this conversation on race. And I thought he took a middle ground that was admirable, even inspiring. At one hand, he sort of swatted away people who say, we've made no progress in this country. Well, we know we've made progress. And the fact that this Selma thing was going on, that John Lewis, who crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge in 1965 and was beaten to within an inch of his life by, you know, Alabama state troopers, is now a congressman and a black caucus, one of the most respected politicians in the country, that we have an African-American president, that George W. Bush is there with his wife. They walk across the bridge. Obviously, we've made progress. But then the president pivoted, and he said, to those who think that, oh, the Constitution, all, we're all in this happy, you know, kumbaya, colorblind society, everything's been cured. No, he said, we haven't. And he pointed to these cases of these shootings, and I think he was right to do it. And this tragedy that's happened in your state, I mean, underscores this point. Mm-hmm. We aren't there yet. And I thought the president really handled that. I was inspired by it, actually. Look, I've covered presidents. I don't usually get inspired by their speeches, but this one was different, I thought.
Well, and I think, you know, that you can't ignore the fact that the report on Ferguson came out right before the Selma anniversary, that Tony Robinson was killed in Madison, an unarmed black teenager killed by police. Are we finally reaching a national tipping point in terms of race, and on top of that, policing and what policing means? Is, you know, it's getting to the point where this is happening so frequently. If this isn't going to really bring up that national dialogue, I don't know what is.
Well, look, Judith, this country's never stopped talking about race, and it shouldn't. But I guess I would argue to you that, you know, the old phrase, one step forward and two step back, that's happened in a sense. Since 9/11, these police departments have become more militarized. They've got all this, you know, literally all this crap from Iraq, all these weapons and, you know, SWAT teams and tanks and all this, you know, stuff they don't need. And the militarization of the police in this country is a national, can I say national scandal? It is a big issue. And in one sense, it has nothing to do with race, which is to say it's happening all over. In Fairfax County, Virginia, near where I live, they shot a white guy through his doorstep with a SWAT team and didn't go in for hours to even retrieve the body, and he bled to death. The militarization of the police is a big national issue that we need to confront. The FBI can tell you, they can tell you how many bicycles were stolen in Madison, Wisconsin last year. The FBI Uniform Crime Statistics has that. They can't tell you how many people were shot to death by police departments in this country. The Justice Department estimated it was 600. Turns out it's more than twice that, and we still don't know the exact answer. We don't know how many people they killed, let alone how many were black, let alone how many of those black people were unarmed. Mm-hmm. And this is something that needs to be dealt with. And it's a police problem, number one, a policing problem. But if you're in the minority community, it's falling disproportionately on you. And so in this sense, you know, we haven't made progress. In this sense, we may be going backwards. And I think that the Attorney General realizes this, and the President doesn't, and he's trying to focus attention on it.
And, you know, that was one of the things that came out in the Ferguson report, was that the arrest of African Americans was basically seen as an income generator.
Well, yeah. I mean, think of this. You've got these horror stories of parking tickets, people paying, you know, they owe $70 and there's interest and penalties, and, you know, they paid $300 or $400 and they still owe $500, and then they're jailed. I mean, that, you know, you just hope that wouldn't happen in mm-hmm. this country. Mm-hmm. And again, why is it allowed to happen? Well, partly it happens because the police force doesn't think of itself as a community, as part of the community, mm-hmm. because they're not part of the community. They don't live there. You know, when Clinton was president, and Bill Clinton, he used these phrases interchangeably, community policing and proactive policing. They're actually opposite approaches. Proactive policing is the hardcore stuff they do in New York City. Community policing is what they try, they've been trying in places like Los Angeles, and I think Minneapolis. But you need a combination of both. You need to have scientific metrics where you go where the crime is, and you have a strong police presence where the crime is. But you also need to have officers who live in the community and think of themselves as part of the community.
Right, and that the community thinks of as part of their community.
That's right, and look, and let's not, and I don't mean to be disingenuous here or just speak in bromides, and that means if you have a, I'm not saying you have to have a firm quota system, but if you have a town that's 70% African-American, you can't have 2% of the cops be, you know, African-American and the rest be white. I mean, it does mean that. And again, not strict quotas, not even lenient quotas, mm-hmm. but you do have to have a sense that the police department looks like the people it's policing.
There has to be a reflection.
I think so.
We have a couple callers that I want to make sure we leave time for. Let's go back to the phones, and Seymour is up in from Madison. Hi, Seymour.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
You want to hear what my complaint is? The speaker, in answering the remark that, after all, Jeb Bush and Scott Walker had private accounts in which they did business, said, well, they're not subject to the law. Well, as far as we know, Hillary didn't break any law. It's not a question of law. It's a question of ethics. And if she had an unethical behavior, they had an unethical behavior, and he ought to recognize that fact. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Seymour. Carl?
Well, you know what? He had his say. I'm not going to... That's a legitimate viewpoint. I'm not going to be defensive about it. What I said was that they weren't covered by the Presidential Records
Act. Right.
That's something I do know about. I don't know what the Sunshine Laws in Florida require. But you know what, though? In a sense, this idea, I'd expect a liberal to be more suspicious of this defense. Will they all do it? Which, Lanny Davis, I mentioned, he's close to the Clintons, and he really is a friend of mine. We're very close, but he's been saying this. I find that singularly unpersuasive and unworthy of a liberal, because it's the Nixon defense. They all do it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, they may or may not all do it, but secondly, that's not a defense. For purposes of this story, right now, Jeb Bush is not, you know, if Jeb Bush starts ranting and raving about it, I guess we have to look at him, too. She's a federal office holder. The question is, you know, where are these emails? We don't need to go further than that yet. You know, at some point, we'll bring in state officials, I guess. But you have the President of the United States saying that he expected all these things would be followed, and they weren't. You have Hillary Clinton firing people for doing what she was doing, and I think we need to stay with this story for mm-hmm. now and see where it leads.
We're getting a little short on time, so I want to make sure that we can... But I just want to make sure that we get to Willem in Colfax. Willem, you're up.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about Scott Walker was criticized for not, you know, being conservative enough, apparently, by some big supporter of conservative movements in this country. So he then put in this ban at 20 weeks for abortions, which is, according to bioethics, bioethicists and other medical people, this is really a dangerous thing, because lots of times after 20 weeks, when abortions are very rare after that, but when they do occur, they usually have something to do with the health of the woman, either that or the inviability of the fetus. So I think this is another example of Scott Walker using our state for his bona fides as a really the most right-wing candidate for president.
Thanks for that call, Willem. And Carl, how would you respond to that?
I can't really speak to that. I know nothing about it. So I'm just gonna say I try to stay in my area, or at least sort of where what's plausibly my area, so people won't be able to say and be correct, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. So I'll stay out of that.
Well, and from where you're sitting, do you see Walker as a viable presidential candidate for the Republicans?
Well, you know, some people do, Judith, but I gotta say, here's the problem. We used to call this being presidential, and political consultants will say this privately. They used to say it publicly. Close your eyes, and who can you see in the White House? And that's the first test, right? And obviously, we can see Hillary Clinton in the White House. She's been there.
Mm-hmm.
Jeb Bush, sure. I mean, and it didn't always win. Mitt Romney, yeah. I mean, he was Hollywood. You know, he was Central Casting's idea of what a president might look like. Scott Walker, I don't see it yet. And I guess he's got to make that case, and he's got to make that case in the upcoming primaries if he runs. David Vondrelli is a very gifted writer for Time magazine who lives in the Midwest. He lives in Kansas City. He and I were doing an event on Hillary Clinton, talking about her career at the Kansas City Library. Overflowing crowd, very pro-Clinton crowd. And Jeb, we got one question about Jeb, and David said, look, if this guy's name was Jeb Ellis, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Mm-hmm. We'd be saying, well, the Republicans have their person, you know?
Right.
And it would be, in some ways, as inevitable as Clinton. And so, you know, Bush is the guy you can see there. Somebody else is going to have to, I think, make people see them as president.
Mm-hmm.
From where I sit, Walker hadn't done that yet.
Carl, I want to bring Camille and Madison in for a very quick comment. Camille, thanks for joining us.
Hi. When Kathleen comes back, tell her she missed one of her best programs. This has been very, very good. I'm weighing in. I'm a Republican. Not all listeners are leaning left. I'm a Republican lifelong. And I am taking a look at Scott Walker, who I have supported.
Okay, I'm so sorry, Camille, but we have 30 seconds left. So sorry to cut you off there, but thank you for calling in, and I'm glad you've enjoyed the program. And Carl Cannon, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, anytime, Judith. Apparently we make a good team.
Well, I like to think so. And say hello to your sister, Judith, as well.
I will.
Carl Cannon is Washington Bureau Chief of Real Clear Politics, and he joined us today for All Things Political. I hope you'll stay tuned for another hour of a great program. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.